insights from economics and economic thinking can actually help us make progress with climate change.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, IMF economist Divya Kirti on the economics of climate change and why a carbon tax is a good idea.
With the right kind of carbon price, individual firms, individual consumers don't need to understand the full impact of their actions. They don't need to understand exactly how their actions might make an island halfway around the world much less livable. All they need to do is respond to prices. And somewhat naturally from that, they'll actually end up finding the best ways to mitigate climate change. My name is Divya. I'm an economist in the IMF's research department, and I've been at the IMF about 5 years now.
So climate change affects so many aspects of our lives. It's hard to know really what approach to take when it comes to trying to do something about it. Part of your research looks specifically at Pigouvian taxes as something that economists can use to mitigate climate change. What are they and how do they work?
Yeah, so to start to understand how economists think about climate change and how it should be addressed, it's worth starting with the idea of externalities. So externalities are the impact of choices that decision makers make on others. And economists are often particularly concerned about cases where these externalities are negative and not really very easy for the decision maker to understand, right? So a kind of standard example of this would be a factory that, as part of its work, dumps waste in a river and ends up poisoning the drinking water supply in a completely different region. That would be an externality. And similarly, burning fossil fuels and releasing greenhouse gases that then stay in the atmosphere for centuries, potentially making poorer regions in the same country or other countries completely uninhabitable, or making life very difficult for future generations to come. That's another example of a negative externality. And the way that economists think about externalities and how to address them often starts from the work of Arthur Pigou, a British economist who published a book in 1920, so about 100 years ago now, arguing that in such cases where there is a negative impact on someone else, harmful actions should be taxed to the point that decision makers then account for the full negative impact that they might have on others. And these kinds of taxes are now known as Pigouvian taxes. So there are some examples of these kinds of taxes out there in the real world. So one that some people may have come across is surcharges for drivers that take their cars into congested city centers. And by doing so, they might make traffic worse for other people. So Singapore and London are both examples of places where these kinds of taxes exist. Now, to economists, climate change looks and feels like a kind of standard externality problem. And economists have been thinking about it this way for a while. And so this economist, Alan Knieze, in an article in the American Economic Review in 1971, right, so 50 years ago, suggested that we should think about applying something like a carbon tax to the situation, arguing with exactly the kind of optimism you would hope for from an economist that, I'll quote from the paper here, acceptably rational pricing of environmental resources is by no means a hopeless task. Right, but the idea is kind of simple. The idea would be just to fully price greenhouse gas emissions, and then firms and consumers could then go about finding the best ways to cut their emissions. And it's worth remarking on the extent to which there's consensus among economists for this kind of policy. So in a profession that's famous for disagreement, right, economics is a kind of unique profession where two people can get a Nobel Prize at the same time for saying opposite things. Despite the kind of disagreement amongst economists in general, there's actually quite a lot of agreement that something like a carbon tax is the way to go. But while there are some places where there are examples of policies like a carbon tax, so the EU, California, or other countries are considering them, it does continue to be the case that most global emissions are not covered by something like a carbon tax.
Okay, so if there's so much consensus among economists, what makes the climate change problem so hard?
Right, and this is the natural question about this. So the idea of these Pigouvian taxes has been around for 100 years. The idea of applying them to the climate problem has been around for 50 years. There's a lot of agreement that this is a good idea, so why aren't we doing it already? And for most kind of economic policies that matter at all, there tend to be people who gain from these policies. There are winners, but then there are also losers. And the potential losers from economic policies don't like the idea of having them. You know, a very natural example of this is companies that produce fossil fuels. This is an industry that has been really very profitable for many, many years, for a long time. And carbon taxes might make being a fossil fuel producer less profitable. Indeed, consistent with this idea, there has been some publicity in recent months suggesting that some large fossil fuel producers have publicly supported the idea of a carbon tax, while privately hoping that something like this doesn't happen. But there are also people that, you know, individual consumers that feel like they have something to lose from carbon taxes. And I'm most struck when I think about people that are dependent on cars for their way of life and their necessities, right? So people who need to drive to get to work or need to drive to go to the grocery store. And many of these people feel like they're already struggling now, and they don't really know where they would find the resources to afford more expensive driving just for the necessities of life. And then there's an important international dimension to this question. And many people that live in developing countries think it's important to note that quite a large share of all of the greenhouse gas emissions, really since they started, have come from advanced economies. So these are countries where people are relatively wealthy, they have good living standards, and even now, in these kinds of countries, their emissions are per person quite large compared to developing economies. And so some people in developing economies feel like they need to raise living standards for their people as well, and maybe that might require them to continue to emit greenhouse gases as well. So the idea of winners and losers, that's one important kind of dynamic to keep in mind. But it's worth remembering that if we continue with business as usual, then everyone is a loser in the long term. We have only one planet, and making it unlivable is a problem for everyone.
So your research also looks at the real impact of sustainable investing, which is a trend now, and how markets could ultimately nudge firms toward fewer emissions. What is ESG investing, and can growth in this type of investing help push firms to act more responsibly, do you think?
Yeah, so let me note here that this, the work you described, this is some co-authors and I recently published a working paper, and let me observe that the views here represent our own views and not other people at the IMF. But exactly as you say, in part because progress on carbon taxes has been so difficult, there has been much more attention and optimism in recent years about ways in which markets could kind of self-correct. And one of those developments has been really dramatic growth in sustainable investing in recent years. And just to give you a sense of that growth, one study finds that half of all new flows to investment funds in Europe actually went to investment funds that described themselves as being sustainable. And this sustainable investing is increasingly synonymous with what you refer to with ESG investing. And so what is that? ESG investing refers to the idea of incorporating environmental, social, and governance considerations. And the kinds of things that sustainable funds do is that they prioritize firms that receive good ESG scores for their investments. Now, in principle, sustainable finance perhaps could make a difference in helping to push firms to behave in a more responsible way, right? Because a key function of financial markets is to channel finance to the most productive areas, including by generating prices that everyone can see, so that everyone can have some sense of where new funds would be most useful. And so maybe as part of this, what ESG investing could do is to shift resources towards green activities and away from areas that have large carbon footprints. But unfortunately, our findings suggest that the idea that sustainable finance on its own can make a big difference is a little bit of wishful thinking. And as context for this, again, because carbon emissions stay in the atmosphere for so long, climate scientists have been telling us, you know, including in another IPCC report in recent days, that globally we'll kind of get to the point of no return for avoiding some of the most serious costs of climate change quite soon, just in about the next 10 to 15 years. Unfortunately, our work suggests that even quite large ESG improvements wouldn't change this timeline by very much. We might buy ourselves only an additional 1 or 2 years.
That's not very encouraging. But the concept is pretty simple. You know, cleaner firms attract conscientious investors and dirty firms lose out. Why doesn't it work?
Yeah, so the way we think about this, there is a kind of fairly straightforward precondition that needs to be in place for sustainable investing to help us mitigate climate change, to help us avoid the worst of climate change. And this is kind of intuitive. So in order for this to help, what needs to be the case is that investors need to reward firms that reduce their contributions to climate change over time, and importantly then, and penalize firms that increase their contributions to climate change. Unfortunately, what we find in our work is that the main indicators that are used by investors, like these ESG scores, don't actually do this. So firms that have growing contributions to climate change, so growing emissions, are not in fact penalized by worse ESG scores. And firms with falling contributions to climate change, firms that are helping, are not rewarded by better ESG scores. So the way we think about it, ESG investing is a little bit like a train that's heading down the wrong track. And before we talk about speeding the train up or maybe getting more people on the train, our view is that we need to be more focused on getting the train back towards the right kind of track.
All right, so ESG scoring is based on environmental, social, and governance factors, as you explained. Does this scoring lean equally on all three of those pillars?
Yeah, so this is actually a really interesting question, Bruce. So something that's important to note is that the multidimensionality of ESG, both in the way that the scores are constructed and in the way that investors approach ESG, is a really central part of the way that this movement works. So ESG, just by its very nature, aims not only to capture issues like carbon emissions, but a whole host of other things, right? So inequality of pay, customer privacy and customer welfare, the quality of corporate governance. Right, so in principle, ESG aims to capture all of these. It seems fair to say that for many investors, what attracts them to ESG is really climate. Climate, for many, is in some sense the headline cause. But this kind of multidimensionality and capturing many things at the same time is also part of the draw. And if it were possible to do everything at the same time, to capture all of these issues well at the same time, this might be a good idea. But it is possible that trying to do all of these things at the same time makes it difficult to do any of them well. I should note, though, that what I said about ESG scores, overall ESG scores, also applies specifically to environment scores. So it's also not the case that firms' environment scores capture their contributions to climate change. Even though ESG score providers actually tend to be in broad agreement about how firms should be scored on this environmental dimension.
So what kind of data do they use to determine how much carbon emissions firms are actually using, or is it purely voluntary?
This is another great question. So data, it turns out, is actually really hard to come by in this area. It's an area where there's not a lot of transparency for investors. And what that means is that there are also a lot of opportunities for firms to say things that make them look good, as opposed to actually changing their business models, which might be profitable. So one example of this is that firms that say that they recognize that climate change brings risks for their businesses, perhaps without actually doing anything about their business models, tend to get better ESG scores.
So if there's such a lack of data, where do you get your data? I mean, how do you know that this is happening?
So we rely on some work by the Climate Accountability Institute that finds something actually quite interesting. So they show that less than 100 firms have accounted for 70% of all carbon dioxide emissions since the beginning of the industrial era. And you know, because burning fossil fuels is the main way that greenhouse gases are generated, these firms are largely, although not only, fossil fuel producers. And so what the Climate Accountability Institute does, they estimate the emissions that would be generated from actually using the fossil fuels that are produced by these firms. And so we're able to work with data for a group of about 50 of these firms, where we have, you know, estimates of their actual emissions and also their ESG scores. And this is an important set of firms. So that these are firms that account for a third of global emissions over our sample period. And so in some places, actually, there's better information out there already. And part of what we need is just more focus on this. But more broadly, there are a lot of firms where information on their carbon footprints is just not available. And better disclosure standards, and perhaps just as importantly, requirements to disclose this information are part of what's needed in a way to move the ESG train toward the right track. But also, you know, while progress in these areas would help, building consensus around and then also actually implementing policies like carbon pricing are probably still an important part of the picture for helping both firms and investors fully account for the costs of their emissions and really meaningfully move towards mitigating climate change.
So there is indeed a lot of economics behind the problem of climate change. How much would you say economics as a field has been part of the problem? And to what extent do you think economics can be part of the solution?
Well, I think two important types of things are worth noting here. The first is that we should not forget that over the period where we've had really large greenhouse gas emissions that have led to the climate problem, we shouldn't gloss over that over that period, there's also been dramatic economic progress. You know, huge improvements in living standards for a lot of people. You know, lives have gotten better, health has improved, life expectancy has improved. And you know, many people now don't have that much uncertainty about the basic needs of life, although we haven't gotten there for everyone, right? But there has been a lot of economic progress over this period. Nevertheless, some would argue, kind of consistent with your question, that what mainstream economics has been doing over this period is to focus a little bit on an incomplete picture, and maybe to focus a little bit too much on profits and current profits in ways that are not that helpful. And one interesting example of this point of view is the Dasgupta review in the UK. So what this review argues is that part of the problem is that we just have not accounted so far for the fact that a stable climate might be valuable. A natural environment that leaves room for biodiversity might be valuable. So we just have not been keeping track of the value of natural assets and the livability of the planet when measuring economic progress in terms like GDP. And so maybe by taking a broader approach, we could kind of move towards a world where we do continue to try to improve living standards, but in ways that don't degrade the climate or the environment more broadly. And so I think that's one important example of how insights from economics can actually help us make progress with climate change.
Fascinating stuff. Divya Kirti, economist in the research department at the IMF. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks very much, Bruce, for having me.
Look for Divya's working paper titled Limits to Private Climate Change Mitigation at imf.org. You can read lots more about how economists around the world are looking at the problem of climate change in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine, including an article by Partha Dasgupta, author of the Dasgupta Review that Divya referred to in the podcast. Check it out at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.